This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Last weekend, Iran launched a direct drone and missile strike against Israel. It was their response to an Israeli attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus a couple of weeks before, which killed seven people, including a top commander. Israel's military chief of staff has said the Iranian attack will not go unanswered, though, as of right now, there's been no retaliation. But retaliation begets retaliation. And the risk of the Israel-Gaza conflict escalating into a regional war involving Iran seems real. So what does Iran want? And what will it risk to get it? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let me introduce you to my guests. Shashank Joshi is defence editor at The Economist. Dr. Roxanne Farman-Farmayon is a lecturer at Cambridge University, specialising in the politics of Iran and the Middle East. And Ali Vaez is Iran Project Director at the International Crisis Group in Washington. Shashank Joshi, if I can ask you first, since the weekend, what more have we learned about Iran's attack on Israel? And is there anything in what we've learned that should surprise us?
Good afternoon, David. I think the striking thing about this attack is that it was at the same time both unprecedented and calibrated. It was unprecedented in its size. This was probably the biggest one-day missile attack we've ever seen, bigger than anything Russia has fired at Ukraine on a single day, including 120 ballistic missiles, which is an extraordinary number. And it was unprecedented in that it was the first ever attack we've seen directly from Iranian soil against Israel. But it was also calibrated in the level of warning time that was given to Israel, allowing it to engage in that incredible interception, and in the choice of targets. And I think we've just got to accept it was both of these things at the same time.
Ali Vaez, was it a success from Iran's point of view, do you think?
Well, the reality is that the Iranians had to square a difficult circle in the sense that they wanted to retaliate against the Israeli attack on their consulate in Damascus without triggering a broader escalation or a direct confrontation with Israel and the United States. And that's why I think they, through a high degree of coordination, directly and indirectly with the United States, signaled exactly what they were going to do. And they were hoping that this would be an attack that would mostly fail. And it did.
Right. OK. Roxanne Farman-Farmayon, what do you think the political intention of Iran was?
I think it was to show very much that they had, hello, first of all, that they had a capacity for strategic defense, that they were operating pragmatically, and that they were operating with restraint. And I think in many ways that's their intention was to impact the situation, not contribute to escalation, and to stop Israel from attacking their officers, their military officers, with impunity, because this was not the first time since October 7th. In fact, up until then, there had been attacks by Israel on over seven cases where the Revolutionary Guard had lost officers. So it was to stop this the killing that was taking place that they were suffering from.
Shashank Joshi, if I'm sitting in Tehran right now looking at the world's reaction to this attack and also Israeli reaction to this attack, we don't yet know how and when they're going to retaliate, if at all. Would I be thinking to myself this was a success?
I think they have achieved some degree of deterrence. They've shown that they've got the capacity to conduct these kind of strikes. But I think they've also come out of this diplomatically very isolated. They saw not just Israel's Western allies, but also some Arab countries assist in shooting down these missiles. And, of course, it has distracted attention from Gaza. So you can chalk it up in different ways, but I think that they also look pretty isolated at this moment in time.
Ali Weiss, do you think Israel sought this escalation in the Damascus attack? Because the timing of it is hard to understand in some ways. Or was it simply an opportunistic attack because they knew that all these senior commanders would be in this particular place at this one time?
Well, it does appear that Israel miscalculated because they believed that in the past 7 months they had been targeting Iranian assets and personnel in Syria. They had killed, by that point, about a dozen Revolutionary Guards command soldiers and commanders in Syria, and Iran had not really pushed back. So they thought this would be part of a pattern. But the reality is that both the seniority of the people they targeted in the consulate, and the fact that it was an attack against a diplomatic facility, which from the Iranian perspective was akin to an attack on their own soil, was where they miscalculated and pushed Iran to feel that Israel has gone too far and there was a need to try to restore deterrence.
Shashank, what do you think?
I think that's exactly right. This attack was not opportunistic. This was, from what we now understand, about 2 months in the making. It was approved by the Israeli War Cabinet, and they expected, they gamed out some of the potential responses. And what they thought was that they would see a low-level Iranian response. So you could say this is an intelligence failure, just as October 7th was an Israeli intelligence failure.
Roxanne Farman, I want to move now to the question of the Iranian government itself, who's making the decisions and the context within which they are making decisions. And listeners to this programme have heard several programmes that we've made about Iran over the years. And during that period of time, it seems to be that actually the regime has become harder line than it was, rather than softer line, as many people expected. Can you take us through who's in charge and how they run the place?
I would agree with the assessment that the government has become harder line. In fact, what we've seen over the last several years is that the reformists, of which the previous president was part of, or the moderates, are no longer part of the equation. Now we really see a government that is composed primarily of conservatives. There are divisions between the different conservative camps, but they are hardline. And that means that they are much less willing to compromise foreign policy with the pressures that are coming from the outside. It's very much more internally driven. And the control is very much in the hands of the supreme leader, Khamenei, and an increasingly tight circle of advisors around him, as well as the Revolutionary Guard that has continued to play a larger and larger role, both in politics as well as in the military.
And how much do you think they have to listen to public opinion in Iran? Because this has always been a big question for us. And if public opinion in Iran were dead set against an escalation, you can tell us in a moment what you think about that. Would that alter the position of the ruling elite?
No, I think we've seen that although earlier on in the Islamic Republic, the opinion of the public was considered important, it has become increasingly less so. I think we saw with the level of repression that followed the Mahsa Amini demonstrations, the suppression of that movement, that the government felt very much as though the opinion of the people was not important. We saw that mirrored again in the process that took place in the recent parliamentary elections. The view of the people, the issues that they feel are important, such as the economy or the fact that more and more sectors of the government, of the people, are falling into poverty. This is simply not the driving force for decision making at the top.
Do you mean that there's actually now diminished space for opposition to the government to be effective?
I think the yes, the short answer to that would be yes. And I think that the focus of the government very much is to try to regain legitimacy by focusing more on the Persian Gulf relationships, the deal to reestablish diplomatic relationships with Saudi Arabia, for example, was a big win seen by those that are running the government, and the focus on playing a larger role as a promoter of a single Islamic voice or of the Palestinian rights in this most recent conflict has also been very much where the government is focused.
Ali, Roxanne there was talking about the influence of the Revolutionary Guard. Now, one of the things that we discovered when we last looked at this is how involved the Revolutionary Guard has become with the economy. And one aspect that can happen under those circumstances is that there becomes a kind of vested interest against war because actually they're making a lot of money out of the currency situation. How do you read their position?
Well, the Revolutionary Guards is currently benefiting from circumventing sanctions and basically monopolizing all channels of trade, which have been cut off as a result of the heavy sanctions that Iran is under. But in that sense, you're right. They don't want to change the status quo. But there is a bigger consideration here at this moment in Iran's history, which is the looming prospect of the succession of the supreme leader who just yesterday turned 85. In a way, the Revolutionary Guards would benefit from further escalation at this moment, because even if they end up in a situation of a direct military confrontation, they are of the view that the only thing that poses an existential threat to them is a land invasion that is just simply not on the cards. And therefore, anything less than that would amount to what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And in that sense, they can basically militarize the internal sphere even further and have a bigger role in determining who and what comes after Ayatollah Khamenei, which determines who will be able to preserve their vested economic interest in the system.
Shashank Joshi, given that, can we talk about how active the Revolutionary Guard are abroad? And I suppose the first question is, what were so many Revolutionary Guard senior personnel doing in that consulate in Damascus? And what does that tell us?
Well, we often talk about the Revolutionary Guard. What we mean is the Quds Force, which is a branch of the Revolutionary Guard that deals with external affairs. I mean, you can imagine them a little bit like the SAS, if you like. And I describe these actions as threefold. There's training, there is weapons provision, and there is intelligence. And that is going to Iran's so-called axis of resistance across the region, which includes Lebanese Hezbollah, a very important group in the context of this escalation, but also militias in Iraq and Syria that we've talked about on the show before, David, and the Houthis in Yemen. And just to give you one example, we know that the Quds Force has supplied guidance kits to Hezbollah in Lebanon that has allowed it to make its dumb, unguided missiles into precision-guided missiles that pose a much bigger threat to Israel. So they are strengthening the military capabilities of these armed groups right around Israel as a kind of leverage against the state of Israel.
Roxanne, how are we to understand these relationships that Iran has with, say, Hezbollah and some of these other groups? Are we to understand them as people who have become entirely beholden to Iran and will do whatever Khamenei and the Quds Force say? Or do they exercise significant autonomy and it's not quite as simple as just switching them on and off again?
I would say the latter. It used to be much more of a patron-client relationship. Each one is quite different. The relationship with Hezbollah is very different than the relationship with the Houthis, for example. In all cases, I think greater capacity has been built for these groups to become more independent. Many of them enjoy political legitimacy as elected representatives to their parliament. So the Hezbollah, for example, has a political party representation in the Parliament of Lebanon. The situation in Yemen with the Houthis is that they have command over the capital Sana'a and run the government from there. So we see that these are organizations that have grown over time, are less dependent on Iran as they have gained their own areas of both responsibility and relationships. For example, the Hezbollah are quite close to Syria and have their own relationship with the Assad government there. And likewise, what we see is that they all share common views. They are all anti-American. They're anti-Israel. So there's an ideological link between them. So what might seem more a dependency situation on the outside is perhaps a misperception, because many of these groups are operating in order to attain the same goals, and they're operating together more as partners, I would say, these days than as a pure patron-client relationship.
Well, that can take us on quite neatly to the question of what Iran's military posture and strategic stance actually is and is likely to be. And I think in the first instance, Ali, I'd just like to ask you, you get this blood-curdling rhetoric out of Iran, death to this, death to that, and of course you see the same amongst some of the partner organisations elsewhere. Does that give us a misleading impression of just how aggressive they are? Are they more essentially defensive?
I think it's important to understand that from a conventional military perspective, Iran is much weaker to its rivals in the region. Iranian Air Force dates back from the time of the Shah. So it's basically an Air Force museum, not a real one. And that's why Iran has developed these asymmetric capabilities like its allies and partners in the region. And its ballistic missile program and drones. And they provide it with a degree of deterrence. But at the end of the day, in a direct confrontation with Israel or the United States, for sure, Iran is not able to defend itself. And it doesn't have a security guarantor in the way that, for instance, China provides security for North Korea, which also is a nuclear weapon state, by the way. So a lot of the rhetoric is kind of ideological, and a lot of it is hot air, but it's reflection, I think, primarily of the vulnerability that Iran feels.
Shashank, the thought has just occurred to me that if you're going to fight this asymmetric war using either proxies or partners, depending what you want to call them, you're asking those people to put themselves on the line. In the case of Hezbollah, you're asking them to put the whole of Lebanon on the line. And that must be a kind of tricky strategic position to be in.
It is. And not only that, but if you think about Hamas as part of the axis of resistance, it is also somewhat embarrassing that Hamas did not tell their Iranian patrons that they were launching the attack on October 7th. There's no evidence of that, and that's what most intelligence agencies think. So I think that's another way in which that axis is looking less reliable for Iran, and it is therefore particularly important that Iran has crossed the Rubicon and conducted a direct strike against Israel. The only other thing I'd mention, David, is that we shouldn't be misled by the success of the interception that took place. Had Iran conducted this missile strike without any notice, had it used more ballistic missiles, had it hit a wider range of sites, it would have caused significant damage. So the missile force is really a critical part of its compensation for the conventional weakness that Ali described a moment ago.
I want to understand this even better, because what you've just said, Shashank, essentially is they could have done an awful lot more damage if they'd wanted to, and it wouldn't necessarily have been intercepted. And this is without using Hezbollah or any other kind of force. This is directly from Iran. So the question is, what are they scared of being the response if they were to commit such an attack, which would commit such damage?
I think the principal concern is an attack on Iranian soil that would be of such a magnitude it would threaten the regime's grip on power. But there are clearly also some other scenarios they are worried about. And in fact, just shortly before we're speaking, we have seen Iranian officials say that if there were attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities, which of course have been a target for covert Israeli actions over the past 15 years, they've tried to hint that could prompt Iran to take a different nuclear stance. In other words, hinting they might go towards a nuclear weapon. So I think they're concerned about all those scenarios and really probably hoping that the Israeli response is confined to regional targets, really the same kind of things that Israel has been striking on and off for the previous 6 months.
Alibai, is that also how you see it?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. You know, the reality is that if in response to Iranian attack, Israel targets Iran's soil, it basically proves two things. Number one, that Iran's regional deterrence, this network of partners and proxies, has not been able to achieve the ultimate objective that Iran had in mind, which was to deter a direct attack on its soil. It also showcases Iran's weakness in terms of conventional capabilities, because we will not see the terrible and horrifying scenes that we saw when Iran attacked Israel. But Israel successfully, in terms of its air defense, in terms of its allies who came to rescue, fended off that attack. I think an Israeli attack on Iranian soil is going to be much more successful. And that's why Iranians are so sensitive about it. And if that line is crossed, then I think it is logical for the Iranians, given how close they are to the verge of nuclear weapons, to start considering getting the ultimate deterrent. There is also another consideration here, which is that they're exceedingly, I think, disappointed and not hopeful in being able to use their nuclear capabilities as leverage at the negotiating table to get out from under U.S. sanctions. And that means that from both perspectives of deterrence and also from the perspective of negotiating chips at the table, they are very likely to start considering moving towards nuclear weapons.
And we just heard that some of those sanctions have just been extended. Roxanne, are we to understand that Iran is essentially more frightened than it is feeling that it has a set of opportunities?
Well, I think its view has been expressed very clearly ever since the beginning of the Gaza war that it does not want to see this escalate. And I think we've heard some of the reasons why, that it does well by pinpoint targeting, by using cyber attacks, but that it is not well prepared to confront a modern army, particularly one that uses air power, because its air capability is very constrained. So I think it's a very uneven war that it would be frightened of getting into. And so it has really been communicating that it does not want to get into a war either with the United States or, in fact, with Israel.
Shashank Joshi, I think this takes us towards an if. You can see two forms of Israeli retaliation, low level and not directly on Iran, in which case, in a way, the Iranian attack on Israel could be said to have been a success, or Israel attacks Iran more directly, in which case the danger is there of escalation, but the Iranian attack looks like a failure. What should we be anticipating and what should we be worried about?
My sense, David, is that the Americans and Israel's other Western partners are leaning on it to avoid any substantial retaliation. They recognize that Israel will have to do something, but they are hoping it will remain limited. I think that this episode, particularly Israel's reliance on help from the United States, from the UK, from France, from Jordan, also underscores that Israel cannot simply thumb its nose at allies as it wishes. So that will also shape its decision making. But I think the real test of whether Iran's barrage was a success or not is not going to lie in the coming days. It will lie in the coming months, and it will depend on whether we see more of the kind of Israeli strike that caused this. In other words, are we going to see really contentious strikes on senior Revolutionary Guard commanders? There's been about 18 of them killed so far, along with 300 Hezbollah fighters. And are we going to see them killed in sensitive places or in novel ways? If that happens, I think that will have been a failure. If Israel is more cautious, I think Tehran will say, actually, there was some value in what they might call restoring deterrence.
Roxanne, What do you think the line is, the Israeli retaliatory line, which keeps Iran from taking further action, and that, or which crosses it into provoking Iran to effectively escalate? Where do you think that would be?
Well, I agree that it there's such a huge difference between if Israel attacks Iran directly on its own territory or whether it attacks it regionally and against its various partners. I think that what Iran would like out of this is to have the focus taken off of the Iran-Israel conflict that is clearly now the new turn of events, and to put the focus back onto Gaza and the famine and the difficulties that Israel has been facing in that particular theater. So I think it will be doing its best to work with its Arab Gulf neighbors to try to contain this so that it does not, first of all, take the media attention away from the Gaza war, but second of all, that this does not expand into a full-scale conflict between Israel and Iran.
Just a follow-up question on that, Roxanne. Do you think that the Iranians do feel that what has happened has taken the attention off the Gaza war and that that has been a problem for them?
Well, it certainly is something that I think they do feel strongly, because they've been promoting a single Muslim message about Gaza. This has been very much their focus has been the Palestinian cause. So they have tried to step away from having this escalate. And now exactly what they were trying to avoid has come to pass. I think that there's also quite a bit of unrest about this internally. And although, as I've said, it's not significant to the government, it definitely makes it more difficult to manage the internal when that is not supportive at all of what's happening on the outside.
Ali Weiss, we've got about a minute to go, but I must put to you the point that the big problem was always supposed to be how Iran might push Hezbollah into a full-blooded confrontation with Israel. It was the thing that we were all worried about. From everything that's been said here, I'm hearing effectively that that's not really something that Iran wants to do, and probably not something Hezbollah wants to do either.
That's absolutely right, David. I think Hezbollah is the option of last resort for Iran. It's its most important asset in its network in the region, and it doesn't want to sacrifice it for anything short of defense of its homeland. And it knows that if Israel goes after Hezbollah, Iran's deterrence would be much more weakened. And so it really wants to keep that powder dry until and unless it is facing a major threat from Israel. And we're not at that point yet.
Shashank Joshi, finally, right now, should I be scared about an escalation, very scared about an escalation, or terrified about an escalation?
I think you're okay simply scared, David. But October 7th changed the Israeli psyche, and that is why they went after Hezbollah in Iran with this renewed pressure. So even if we get away on this occasion, I think we are going to see an Israel that is more concerned, more aggressive about pushing back that Hezbollah threat in the months to come, and that will continue to present really serious problems.
Well, that's all we've got time for, I'm afraid. My thanks to my guests, Shashank Joshi, Ali Weiss, and Roxanne Farman-Farnam. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Sally Abrahams, Ben Carter, and Kirstine Knight. The editor was Richard Barden, and the programme was mixed by Neil Churchill. Another edition of this podcast will be along again really soon.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumors, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day, and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.